From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we meet a University of Michigan professor who survived a Nazi concentration camp.
Well, you live in constant fear. Every moment, you don't know what'll happen from one moment to the next. And then, I'm always reluctant to admit, you get used to it.
And why we don't have enough primary care physicians.
A 65-hour work week for a primary care doc, and he's going to make one half of what a cardiologist makes, kind of drives that train the other direction. And we're trying to do everything we can to combat that issue.
And we look back to when frog legs were king on Detroit dinner tables.
It was said by some that there was more frog legs in Detroit than there were in France at one point in time.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Michigan could become the first state to use a roadside saliva test for marijuana. That's if lawmakers pass a package of bills introduced in the legislature. The intent? To get repeat drug offenders off our roads. The bills have bipartisan support and the backing of the Michigan State Police. But Michigan's medical marijuana community worries the saliva test could show presence of the drug whether or not drivers had recently used marijuana. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we speak with State Representative Dan Lowers. He's sponsoring the legislation. Also on the show, what needs to happen in the education process to correct the big imbalance between specialist physicians and primary care physicians? But first, the upcoming August primary ballot will feature something not usually seen on August primary ballots, a statewide ballot proposal. We haven't seen that in August since 2002. This proposal would determine the fate of a reform of Michigan's industrial personal property tax. But there is a pretty significant hurdle backers have to face, that icky little three-letter word, tax. Chris Gouts is a reporter for Crane's Detroit Business. Chris, what would this ballot proposal do if it's passed in August?
Well, it would allow for a significant reduction in business taxes, and it would also ensure a dedicated funding stream for local communities, so especially those that are almost in some cases solely dependent, and in some cases are quite largely dependent on this tax revenue, to make them whole, because it draws in revenue from a variety of sources, and that's actually what the language of the ballot proposal is about. It's not about repealing the tax that's already been done. Mm-hmm. And what this is doing is creating the funding mechanism, and part of that is going to be from a further assessment on businesses that already pay a personal property tax, but obviously at a much reduced level now. And then it also redirects a portion of the state's use tax, which is the tax that in some cases nobody pays when they buy something on Amazon, but it also brings in revenue in other areas. And then it also will direct money that previously was going to tax credits for certain businesses that largely came about during the Granholm administration, for different things, battery credits and things like that, some of the mega credits that will soon expire, and then that money will then be freed up to apply to this.
Just for a sense of context, especially for folks who aren't involved in business per se, remind us what that personal property tax was. How did it work and why was it repealed?
It's basically, for a lot of manufacturers, it's a tax on all of their personal property. So, and this goes to another problem that supporters are having with the taxes, because it's worded really poorly. It's personal property. So when people see it, they think personal property, that must mean me.
That must
be my house
or
property that I have in my house. It's not that at all. It's the property that businesses have in their location. So it could be, a mill or a lathe or even a desk or a computer. And so businesses have to go around every year and they have to, look at everything that they have, and then they put it on the sheet, and then the tax assessor comes in and takes a look at it. And then they have a depreciation schedule that goes down. But the property never completely depreciates. So they're always paying tax. So Charlie Pride from Ford was sort of joking that, my boss's grandfather, still has the property that he paid sales tax on when he bought it at Ford and all these other manufacturers. And they're still having to pay, albeit a very reduced amount of tax, they're still having to pay tax on each piece of property that they have. And so a lot of businesses see this as sort of a double taxation. They already pay tax when they bought it as sales tax. And then they just continue to have to pay this personal property tax on those pieces of equipment into perpetuity. And so no other state in the Midwest has such a tax except for Indiana, and it's at a much reduced rate, and it's at some point in time the tax actually goes away. So unlike Michigan's, which is basically forever. So this was something that they've always wanted to do. Governors in the past have always hated us. They've always wanted to find a way to get rid of it. The problem is that communities are just so dependent on it that they couldn't figure out the funding mechanism, and now they have. And so that's now where we're at now, is to try to get the public to buy into this and agree to support the change.
So why is this not on the November ballot?
That's a very good question, and I asked, you know, different lobbyists, the lawmakers that were involved in this, the reason why, and I have a guess, and it was sort of confirmed by the folks that I talked with, but nobody could really put a good figure on it. But this all came about during the lame duck session of 2012,
mm-hmm.
and if we remember anything from that lame duck session, it's right to work.
That's
that
right.
was the guy, all the headlines. But it was a few days after that they passed this elimination of the personal property tax. It went way late into the morning. They finally got enough votes and cobbled it together before they all went home for the year. And my guess, and it was backed up by a few people that I talked with, my guess is that they put it on the August 2014 ballot back then, because it would have only been a month or so removed from the situation we saw on that previous November's ballot, where we had five constitutional amendments and they all failed.
Mm.
And when you have so many things on a November ballot, there was a very successful Just Say No campaign that even, you know, the governor and other individuals were trying to get rid of, you know, Just Say No to the union proposal and to the clean energy proposal and the bridge proposal. And so I think there was probably some fear that if we put it on the November ballot, it might get swept up into whatever might come under this November's ballot. And there's actually going to be as many as 8 proposals on the November ballot. So by putting it in August, you keep it to itself. And you're also having a much smaller and a more committed group of voters that come out for the August primary. So you're looking at a smaller audience you have to target.
Okay. Now I know supporters, as you write about in Crane's Detroit Business, supporters are really having to wrestle with the way that lawmakers wrote this ballot proposal. How many times is the word tax or taxes used?
Eight different times. and it sort of goes to the complexity, not that this is any sort of scientific measure, but I think it counted more than 24 words that have more than 3 syllables. So, I mean, if you just kind of look at it, it's just very clunky, a lot of big words. And so for people that are just looking at this, you would have no idea what this means, because it also doesn't include the phrase personal property tax.
Hmm.
So it's kind of clunky, it's confusing, and that's sometimes what you get when lawmakers put this language together and not the Department of Elections.
And the clock is really ticking. I mean, they've got something like 3 months left. So what are the supporters doing to mount their campaigns? What's different in the campaign for this proposal that we might see from a typical ballot proposal?
Well, I think that's what's really interesting, and Jessica Rosa, who's helped run the campaign on the PR side, made the point that this is really not a traditional statewide campaign. You can't have the governor and, you know, maybe the mayor of Detroit standing in front of the cameras on a TV commercial saying, you know, vote for this, this is good. They don't have any connection, really. So in order for this to win, they're really having to dig down into the grassroots, and they've got more than 700 members of different organizations. It's labor groups, it's businesses, local chambers, police and fire, their unions, their members, community organizations, all supporting this. And so they're all reaching out to their members to try to make the case that this is a really good thing. And so you're probably likely to see TV ads and direct mail pieces that will feature your local sheriff, your local fire chief, your mayor. So they're really trying to make a personal connection in local editorial boards and in local stories that they hope to get printed in local newspapers, the ones that are remaining.
Yeah.
To try to make the case that, you know, this is a good thing. People that local business owners are going to appear in these ads. You know, trust us. You know, this is going to work. This is going to be good for everyone. And so that's the real difference. And so that obviously takes more time and more money to make all those connections and do this kind of thing. Well, luckily, there was a concern early on that some of the municipal organizations were going to oppose this. And so the business group started stockpiling a healthy fund in order to combat that if they needed to. And so they already have about $5.5 million $3 million to spend on this campaign in thinking that they were going to have to fight an organized opposition. Well, they don't have to now. So all that money now can be used into educating voters, and that's really what they're doing now. And you'll probably start to see some of those advertisements in the next month because this is a primary ballot, which means that you're going to have a lot of older voters, and a lot of those voters tend to vote absentee. So about 40 to 40% is estimated voters are going to vote absentee, and they're going to start getting their ballots mailed to them sometime mid to late next month. So they're really trying to make sure that people see this language in some of these advertisements and direct mail pieces pretty quickly. So in the next couple of weeks, you might see some things in your mailbox about from the Michigan Citizens for Strong and Safe Communities.
Well, what if this falls short, Chris? What happens if this ballot proposal gets defeated in August? Then what?
Well, that's another good question. And I think that also goes to why, another reason possibly why that they put this on the August ballot as opposed to November. Because if it were to fail, it does give them a few more months in which to sort of regroup and figure something out. Maybe they could do something legislatively where they find another way to do this that wouldn't require a vote at the ballot. Or it would just, you know, give local assessors and businesses, you know, time to sort of regroup and say, okay, we're going to have to pay this tax again for another year. And so I'm sure that there are contingency plans, but, you know, the optimists that are running the campaign aren't trying to spend a whole lot of time talking about what happens if it fails. They just that they're making the case that this is going to be good because, you know, communities are relying on personal property tax. If a business were to leave tomorrow, you know, that's a huge cut to their local budget. And so they're making the case here that if you do it this way, you no longer have to worry about, you know, if maybe, like, remember when Electrolux left Greenville, it decimated their local budget. You know, if this system were in place, that wouldn't have happened because there would have been a dedicated funding stream for that. That loss wouldn't have impacted them. So that's another case that they're making, is that, you know, please support this. This is going to be good for everyone.
Looking ahead to the personal property tax reform ballot proposal that we will be seeing on our primary ballots in August. So thank you so much, Chris Gouts with Crane's Detroit Business. Always good talking with you, Chris. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. She was born in Germany, but as life for Jews in Germany became more dangerous through the 1930s, she and her family moved to the Netherlands, to Amsterdam, to the same neighborhood as a young girl named Anne Frank. And like Anne Frank, she was captured by the Nazis, rounded up, and taken to the notorious Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. But unlike Anne, young Irene Butter survived the camp. Today, Dr. Irene Butter is a professor emeritus at the University of Michigan's School of Public Health. Her life has been a remarkable journey, knit together by Irene's decision she was going to live as a Holocaust survivor, not as a victim. Irene Butter is the subject of a new film by Ann Arbor filmmaker Evelyn Newhouse. It's titled Never a Bystander. Irene Butter, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you here. And Evelyn, thank you so much for joining us.
How nice to be here.
Irene, tell me, how old were you when you and your family left Germany and moved to the Netherlands?
I was almost seven.
So you were very, very little. And how long was it before you were transported to Bergen-Belsen?
We were deported in 1942.
Okay.
And then came to Bergen-Belsen 44.
Can you give us a sense, in any way, of what a day was like at Bergen-Belsen?
Well, it was a pretty miserable camp. The adults who worked had to get up 5:30, go to work very early in the morning, but I was 14. I didn't have to work. I had other responsibilities. But my day was spent helping clean the barracks, taking care of children whose parents were at work, standing in a big square to be counted for roll call every day, sometimes more than once a day for many, many hours, rain or shine, and standing on line to get the food rations for my family, doing the laundry in cold water and sitting outside, watching it to dry to protect it from the clothes thieves.
People who might see something and think they want it. And when you say getting your food rations, what would a meal be?
Well, there was one meal a day, really, and it consisted of a piece of bread about 2 inches wide and what they called soup, which was basically turnips with water.
And when the adults were at work, what was that work they were sent
well,
to
Well, they
do?
Did hard work. It was really slave labor. The men did all kinds of digging of tunnels and construction work. And then there were something called factories. There was a shoe factory, which meant pulling apart old shoes to save some of the good leather for manufacture of shoes for the soldiers. And then there was an underwear factory where people tore apart old underwear to save the good pieces to make new clothes. Some people worked in the kitchen, which was a privileged job because maybe you could sneak a potato and hide it and take it back to the barrack. But the working days were very long, from 7 in the morning till evening. And once in a while, or frequently actually, there was punishment. Somebody didn't do something that was approved, like staying in the latrine for too long, and then the whole group was punished. And then either they had to go on a roll call, coming home and standing for hours in the square, or the whole camp would be deprived of food for a day or two.
When we who only know World War II and the stories through what we read or what we see in movies through Hollywood. So let's just say a film like Schindler's List. We watch that and we see incredible barbarism toward the people in the camp. Was that happening as well where you were?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I don't think Schindler's List was an exaggeration at all.
And how does that kind of seeing executions and seeing this cruelty, how does that work its way into the heart, or how does a 12 and 14-year-old girl keep herself from being warped by that?
Well, you live in constant fear. Every moment, you don't know what'll happen from one moment to the next. And then, I'm always reluctant to admit, you get used to it. You get used to seeing people killed, and you get used to seeing dead bodies around you.
And you and the family, now how many of you were there, you and your family?
So my parents, my brother, and myself.
So there were the four of you. And then when I read that you were released as part of a prisoner exchange, I don't think many of us knew that that was even going on during the Second World War. Tell us about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's still really not widely known. It wasn't a prisoner exchange. It was an exchange of Jews with mostly South American passports, which were fake, but I think the Nazis knew that, for German civilians who had gotten caught in Allied countries, and when the war started, they couldn't come back to Germany. Mm. So the Germans wanted their citizens back to help win the war. And in that situation, a Jew alive was worth more than a dead Jew.
So you all got out.
300 out of 6,000 people.
Your family, though, yeah. All of you got out.
Yeah.
That is stunning. And what brought you to Michigan? What led you to Michigan?
Well, long journey.
Mm-hmm.
I met my husband at Duke University, where we got our PhDs. And we spent 3 years in Washington, D.C., where he was doing a residency at NIH. And I worked for the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. And then we got jobs here.
And came to Ann Arbor. And now you're Professor Emeritus at the School of Public Health. And Evelyn Newhouse, you had a 35-year career as a healthcare administrator. Now you're a filmmaker, yes?
That's right. It's my retirement career.
It's a great career. And you chose to make a documentary about Irene. What was that about her story that made you say, I must tell her story in this film, Never a Bystander?
I was in the School of Public Health, mm-hmm. and so I knew Irene from that. And in addition, my parents, my father and my mother, were Holocaust survivors. They were not in camps, but they were born in Germany, and they were lucky to get out of Germany.
Yes, they were.
And so I, as a child of Holocaust survivors, I felt very connected to Irene. And we had that in common.
And felt a desire to make sure that this story is told to as many people as possible.
That's right. But I do want to emphasize that for me it was very important to not make the film about Irene a Holocaust story, because I think that where it's very important to remember the Holocaust, it's also important to move on to the future. Mm-hmm. And so it was very important to me to show that one could have such a traumatic childhood, and many people have that, and yet live a full and rich life.
I'm speaking with filmmaker Evelyn Newhouse, whose new film, whose documentary is called Never a Bystander, about the life of Dr. Irene Butter, who is a survivor of the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp and went on to become professor emeritus at the University of Michigan's School of Public Health. And Irene, I know a big key to your story is the decision that you made that you were not going to be a victim, you were a survivor. And when and how did you come to that decision? Was it conscious or did it just kind of evolve?
Well, of course, all of us are victims who've been in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. But some people don't hold on to that victimhood. And they tend to focus on blame and self-pity. And they can't get beyond the suffering of the past. And then there are others who shake that victimhood and decide to live as a survivor. And that means we don't forget the past, but we try to learn from it, and we try to translate it into something good. And so it took me a long time to make that distinction, and it's a process, a gradual process, for me probably in the 1980s. And once I decided I wanted to live my life as a survivor, then the next step was that responsibility to transmit the lessons of the Holocaust. And so I chose to spend a lot of my time going to schools, meeting with students, and talking about what I had learned and what I wanted them to learn.
The film is called Never a Bystander. And that theme, why is that theme so important to you, Irene?
Well, the way I tried to transmit this to the students is Hitler could never have killed 6 million Jews and 3 million other human beings if it hadn't been for so many bystanders. I mean, they're the perpetrators, they're the victims, but then they're the bystanders who don't do anything about it. And so this is a message that I emphasize. And amazingly, it really engages the students. They have never heard that term, and they feel it's really important, and they come up with wonderful comments like, I will never forget this, not being a bystander. I will tell my children and my grandchildren about it. And here's a little boy, 12 years old.
And I know just from having visited the marvelous Holocaust Center in West Bloomfield that there are many other Holocaust survivors who feel that this is a very important mission to get this word out, especially to the young generation, so you feel like you're planting seeds to help prevent this from happening again.
Exactly.
Do you worry that something like that could happen again? I mean, we've got the historic images, we've got the videos. There they are in a way that previous atrocities in mankind's history, we don't have the visual record, but and it really was only 70 years ago. Do you worry about it happening again?
Well, it has happened again. We had genocide in Rwanda, mm-hmm. in the East Congo, in the Sudan. There are many places. We haven't learned the lesson, and that's why it's so important to reiterate it, and as you said, especially to young people.
What do you hope your viewers will be getting out of seeing your film, Evelyn?
Well, I'm hoping to be able to get the film out to school systems and religious institutions. And as part of that effort, two educators have written a study guide that will be packaged with the DVD and will also be on the internet. And that study guide should help teachers to use the film as a teaching tool. And I'm really hoping that the film can be used in that way as a teaching tool.
Well, the film will actually get its premiere May 8th at 8 p.m. at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor. And you can get more information about Never a Bystander by going to the website neverabystander.com. Irene Butter, Holocaust survivor and professor emeritus at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, and filmmaker Evelyn Newhouse. Thank you both so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you so much
for
the invitation.
This is Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Love that. Delicious.
Enjoy.
Num, 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 indeed. A restaurant meal in Detroit these days could mean biting into some great Coney dogs or a plate of flaming souvlaki in Greektown, maybe some great barbecue. But let's roll the clock back, 90 or 100 years. How about some frog leg salad, frog ravioli, frog leg pie? Yeah, it seems early 20th century foodies loved those frog legs, and Detroit was very, very happy to provide them. As one New York columnist gushed in 1905, and here's the quote, "If you have never eaten frog legs in Detroit, you have something to live for, something for which to strive." Food historian Bill Loomis wrote about this oft-overlooked period in Detroit's culinary history for the May issue of Our Detroit magazine. The piece is entitled "When Frogs Were King." Bill Loomis, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Cindy.
I got to tell you, I don't feel particularly, pressed to rush out and have some frog ravioli.
I know. That's a bit of a stretch. But
the Detroiters really did love those frog legs.
They did. In fact, it was said by some that there was more frog legs in Detroit than there were in France at one point in time.
Now, is this a direct link to our French heritage?
That's what they claim. The former owner of a big restaurant in Detroit said that that was the last vestige of our Frenchness, was those frog legs.
That and a few street names that outsiders come in and can't pronounce.
There you go.
So you write that in 1910, Detroit produced, shipped, and consumed 12 tons of frog legs, 6 million pairs of frog legs.
Right.
Now, what was the classic Detroit way to prepare and serve the legs?
Yeah, well, Detroit frog legs were really from the roadhouses. Roadhouses were the little cottagey-looking places that were along the river or along the waterway. Mm-hmm. They went all the way from Detroit to Monroe and then almost all the way to Port Huron.
And I've always heard that term, mm-hmm. and I didn't know really what that meant. Oh.
Yeah, and they were in Grosse Pointe. Like I say, they went in St. Clair Shores, mm-hmm. went all the way up. And people would take the steamers out to these places, or they would drive their buggies out there. And that's where you got the classic Detroit taste. And it was simple. It was just basically frog legs rolled in cracker crumbs and then fried in butter.
So you'd have frog hunters go out and brave the swamps and hunt frogs?
It was an amateur thing. A lot of parties would go out and hunt them. But mostly, if you wanted, the professional hunters were the French Canadians. And they would go out with their tools and bring them in.
Now, when did they start to maybe fade into, as far as importance? Because I do remember seeing frog legs on the menu, and you've got some here that, through the 20th century. But I dare say you'd be a little hard-pressed to find frog legs today.
Yeah, it faded with, they were overfished or overhunted. I'm not sure what the term
loved
is.
Loved to death, yeah, as you put in your article.
They loved them to death. There were just so many that it exhausted. And they tried to pass a law that prohibited selling frog legs off-season, but that went nowhere because there were
like
so
prohibition.
Many.
Like prohibition.
Yeah, exactly. There were just so many of these little roadhouses that were dependent on frog leg income. They did chicken dinners and fried perch and frog legs. It was the sort of standard Sunday fare, and they just couldn't let it go. But that combined with the degeneration of the water quality. Mm. So then when the water got messed up from the industrialization, the people got kind of turned off. But for a while, like at the London Chop House, they would get them from Wisconsin. That was another – that kind of prolonged things a bit longer. But they were selling them up until the 60s, but not nearly in the profusion they had at the turn of the century.
And can they be found today? Is there anyone trying to make frog legs a thing again?
What got me into this is they're kind of making a resurgence in Windsor. They've had a few restaurants that are filling them up and selling frog legs. Now, those frog legs come from Indonesia or Vietnam. They're not from the Great Lakes. But you know, if you want to try them, if it's on your bucket list.
Well, I've got a bite here. Have you eaten them?
I have.
Do they taste like chicken?
They taste like, I had them years ago frozen, and then we heated them up. So I don't know if we did it right. They have a slight fishy taste, but not bad. No, don't make that face.
Okay, don't make a face. No faces.
Yeah, no, they're very, very mild.
Well, it's an interesting piece. Writer Bill Loomis's look at the history of Detroit's love affair with frog legs. You can find it in the May issue of Our Detroit Magazine. And if you are so inclined, he actually gives us a recipe for traditional Detroit frog legs. As always, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a package of bills before state lawmakers right now that could make Michigan the very first state to adopt a roadside test that could tell police whether a driver is under the influence of marijuana. Current law allows police to test the blood, breath, and urine of drivers pulled over for erratic driving. The proposed legislation now being debated would add this roadside saliva test that could tell police if a driver is impaired by pot. State Representative Dan Lowers sponsored this legislation. He's a Republican from Brockway Township near Port Huron. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us what this package of bills aims to do and how it would do it.
Well, really what it aims to do is to bring the Michigan drugged driving laws in line and parallel with our drunk driving laws. So there are really three important changes that are occurring due to this legislation. First, what it allows to do is the arresting officer, if he believes that the person is under the influence of an intoxicant, he is able to issue what's called a 625G permit. That is a paper permit, and it makes it very obvious to any future arresting officers that this person has an open or a pending toxicology case under consideration. That's missing from current law when occurring in drunk driving, but it occurs in drunk driving. So if you're pulled over today for suspected drunk driving, mm-hmm. The officer can issue you a 625G permit right there. While your case is in process, which may take several months, if you're pulled over a second time, it's very obvious to the second arresting officer that you have a pending issue.
Okay, so we've seen that before where somebody gets pulled over and then you find out they've got, you know, a long history. So you're trying to get these these repeat people off the roads.
Exactly, and that's a result of an incident that occurred in St. Clair County last summer. We had two young men from my community that were killed by a driver who was under the influence of controlled substances. And when we got into the case, we found out that this person had six prior instances and six prior toxicology reports waiting to be processed in this state crime lab. So there was no communication system for drugged drivers the way there is for drunk drivers. It's really not so much focused on marijuana as it is any substance that impairs your driving.
Now, talk to us about this roadside saliva test, because, you know, clearly that is drawing a lot of attention, and certainly with the conversation in Michigan regarding medical marijuana, and so there are concerns about this test. How would this work?
Yes. Well, the legislation as it's written allows for a saliva test to be used if it's proven to be effective. However, a saliva test, like a pre-breath test or PBT that they use for alcohol, mm-hmm. is not sufficient evidence to convict anyone. So it's just a tool in the officer's tool bag to help them make an assertion of whether this person is under an influence or not. And we're really hearing a lot from the medical marijuana community about this this legislation. And you know, if you have a medical marijuana card, the presence of marijuana in your system isn't going to prove anything about your condition to be driving at that time, because that stays in your system for several days, you know, or weeks, whatever it is. But so the officer would need, you know, would really need to prove his case with the roadside sobriety test or other methods, you know, because obviously if you've got a card, you probably have that in your system.
Republican State Representative Dan Lowers, who's sponsor of a package of bills that aims to get drugged drivers off the road. The package would include the possibility of making Michigan the first state to formally adopt a roadside saliva test to tell police whether a driver could be impaired from using marijuana. Representative, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
My pleasure.
When we use that term, primary care physicians, we're talking about family practice?
Well, actually, yes, you are talking family practice, but the federal definition of primary care includes family medicine, general pediatrics, general internal medicine, OBGYN for women's health, mm-hmm. And sometimes they even include emergency medicine in there. So that spectrum is all primary care to do that.
And when we talk about a shortage of primary care physicians, it certainly seems like this has been something we've been feeling for a while now. How long have we seen this shortage?
There was a Blue Ribbon panel commissioned by the state of Michigan in the early 2000s, and it included members from Wayne State, University of Michigan, Michigan State, and many of the other people in the state. And at that time, back in the early 2000s, the Blue Ribbon panel identified that Michigan was going to face a shortage of primary care providers by about 4,000 by the year 2020. One of those issues was we looked at that number and we thought it was going, so my college at that time was about 200 students a year. We're at 315 a year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the largest medical school in the state because we raised our class size to try to look at that coming down, because in medical education, you can't just do it one year and have it come out the next. It's about a seven-year process.
Right.
So we graduate about 315. About 50-60% of my students still go into primary care. That's the highest, I believe, of any of the medical schools in the state of Michigan. And the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State is ranked number 9 in the entire nation, U.S. News & World Report, for primary care of all medical schools.
Well, when we look at the fact that the Blue Ribbon panel, you know, a decade ago said we were going to see a 4,000 primary care physician shortage, that was before the Affordable Care Act. How has that impacted things?
Yeah, that's why I made that point,
yes,
because everybody jumps on the fact that Affordable Care Act has got this and this. Really, we knew the shortage was there. The Affordable Care Act now says maybe we're going to be about 5,000 or 6,000 physicians short in primary care, but it really hasn't anything to do with the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with people go into non-primary care. A friend of mine once said they go into what we call specialist care, but he uses the term partialist care. And he said they go into it because they want to control their life. I mean, in primary care, you see everything that comes through the door all the time, and it can be very rewarding, but it is it's sometimes a lot harder to do than if you are a dermatologist or you are a orthopedic surgeon. You know pretty much what you're going to see every day, and you train for that. Family medicine may see headache one patient. They may see somebody with an ovarian cyst the next patient. You got this, and that's all great, and I find that very enthusiastic, but bottom line is, a 65-hour work week for a primary care doc, and he's going to make one half of what a cardiologist makes, kind of drives that train the other direction. And we're trying to do everything we can to combat that issue.
I guess knowing with the Affordable Care Act we're actually going to have more patients in the system means there's going to be more people that you're going to look to try to get into that primary care to keep them healthy before they do need that specialist.
Yeah, well, technically, you know, it's an interesting thing. Everybody says we're going to get more patients in, but realistically, the good thing about the United States system is that even if somebody didn't have health insurance before, they were always seen. If they really had a medical problem, they showed up in the emergency rooms and whatever.
Yeah.
So although we're going to get more people into the primary care offices now earlier, it's really those patients have always been in the system one way or the other, or a majority of those
mm-hmm.
patients have been in the system. The problem we're going to have is this, and it really is primary care in Detroit, Grand Rapids, Lansing, Ann Arbor, it's really not a problem finding a doctor because they're here and they're there. When you go north of Clare, Michigan, it gets very difficult because right now there's a distribution problem. And the biggest problem is you can have 20 family physicians in Detroit, but you have two in the Upper Peninsula. How do we make that thing different? And that's very difficult because we don't just assign people to work in a location. They have to want to go there. What my school is trying to do is we look at, I'm a big believer, if you want somebody to practice in the Upper Peninsula, you need to be able to admit them from the Upper Peninsula.
Got it.
Because if you've never lived there, It's very difficult for somebody that's lived in Dearborn, Detroit, to say, gee, I'm going to send you to Curtis Lake, Michigan. They'll go up there for a week vacation, but to live there through the winter every year requires somebody that comes from that area to know what small-town medicine's like, and we try to look at that issue.
When you talk about training to be a primary care doctor, how long is it? What's the typical residency? Let's say I want to be a general internist.
A general internist would be you go through medical school 4 years, and then you would do a 3-year residency in after you graduate from medical school.
But then let's say contrast that to being a neurosurgeon. You're looking at much longer residencies. You're looking at fellowships. And couldn't one argue that the cost of that specialist training is actually greater to a student than the primary care because you're out earning 7 years after you enter medical school?
Yeah, except that the cost of the medical student really is in the first 4 years. They pay tuition the first 4 years. When they become a resident, in whether they're medicine or surgery or whatever, they're getting paid at least a salary during their residency program. So they're not borrowing money to work in their residency. They're being paid by the system to do that. So, yes, a neurosurgeon would come out of medical school. He would do a first-year, what we used to call an internship. Mm-hmm. Now that's a first-year residency. And then it'd probably be a 4 years of a neurosurgical residency. And then if he wanted to subspecialize, he may go into a fellowship. So you're talking a boarded neurosurgeon could be done in probably 4 or 5 years after medical school. Family physician could be done in 3. General internist done in 3 after medical school. But if you want to be a cardiologist, it's 6.
It's a long time before they can start working off those med school debts.
Well, that, yeah, because they're not being paid a whole lot
sure.
as an intern or resident. And although they can live, most of these people by now are now in their 30s. They usually have a family. They've got children. They have the same problems we all have. How do I pay for my car? My wife wants a house. My wife wants to eat something besides macaroni and cheese.
Sure enough.
Well, in medical school, I lived a year on essentially Kraft macaroni and cheese and turkey legs because the turkey legs were 19 cents a pound.
Boy.
I know now I no longer eat macaroni and cheese or turkey legs.
Those days are behind you.
Those days are behind.
We're speaking with Dr. William Strample, who is Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University, as we look at Michigan health system coping with a dearth of doctors. We have a physician shortage. And so from where you sit as the dean of a school that is training osteopathic physicians, clearly, you're doing a good job getting more than half of your students to go into primary care. But what else can be done in general in medical education to lure more students into primary care? Can you incentivize them to make that choice?
Yeah, and I think that's the real issue. Cost of medical education is tremendous. I mean, the average student we have graduates probably with $180,000, $200,000 debt. And the reason it is because you cannot work even part-time while you're in medical school. It is too rigorous. It's 4 years of your life that you are absolutely committed to. So you're building this debt for tuition and to live on and whatever. So what happens when you're a first-year, second-year medical student, you're running through with everybody else, and you're looking at, let's say you're looking at family medicine.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at family medicine, and if you go out and you're 5 years out and you're in practice and you're doing this, we know right now the average income in Michigan for a family physician runs about $160,000 to $180,000 a year gross. And that's working a 65-hour work week and whatever. And many of us are very happy when we do that. Not a problem at all, okay?
Right.
And if you're used to looking at a job where you're making $60,000, you think, well, God, that's great money. But then you sit next to a guy that is basically going out and he's going to be an orthopedic surgeon, and roughly that same guy goes through the same 4 years of medical school. He goes to an orthopedic residency, and suddenly he gets out, and in 5 years, he's making about $450,000 a year.
Ooh.
If I'm a sophomore in medical school and I have the choice where I could make the decision to go either way, where would I go?
Absolutely.
Because paying off your student loan making $450,000 a year is a lot faster proposition than making $160,000 because it's not just $100,000. Remember, you're now married, you got a family, you got housing, you got cars. So it's not all liquid income. You can just say, gee, you can pay that debt off. So most of the people in primary care have about a 10-year window from the time they graduate from their residency to pay off their student debt. That's like buying a house without getting a house. Wow. In orthopedics, if you did the same thing, you might have a four-year window to pay off your student debt and begin to think about how am I going to put money away for retirement and whatever. That is the disincentive on the primary care side. What we're trying to do in some areas of Michigan, underrepresented, underserved, some of the counties come in with a partnership where they will support paying off some of the student debt if the person stays in their county for 4 years or 5 years. And I see more and more of those. And the state of Michigan contributes to some of that. They're trying through the Center for Rural Health and some of these to match up providers in these underserved areas. And that attracts a lot of people that say, gee, that I can live here. I'm getting the extra money to help pay my student loan. And that brings a person to a small town somewhere that doesn't have a doctor. Those are the kind of programs that probably need to be expanded to do that.
Do we also need to do what you've done at the Michigan State School of Osteopathic Medicine? You enlarged your class size.
All the school. I think Ann Arbor's, I think Jim Wallencroft at Ann Arbor has enlarged his class. I think Wayne State has done that, and I know my sister college at Michigan State has raised a class. The problem for the end result is not just the number of medical students in the, it's the number of residency programs in postgraduate education. And that number was capped by the federal government in 1994. And every intern and resident in every hospital in Michigan is supplied by that federal cap. If they raise the number of residency training slots in primary care, you'd produce more primary care providers. And that's an issue at the federal level, not the state level, to do that.
Big challenges as we look ahead to our shortage of physicians in Michigan, and great insights from Dr. William Strample, who is Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Dr. Strample. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Cindy. I appreciate it.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hadlesy, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Sadeh, Katie Suha, and Jeff Warniak. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.